Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the third talk of the range retreat, the Wassa. It's some of you have been busy on unavoidable things. Some of you have had not so much involvement in anything whatsoever. But each one of you has had some time to meditate. And some of you had lots of time to meditate. And where the circumstances outside have been almost perfect. So sometimes that we should think about and contemplate, and I'm going to talk about this evening, some of the obstacles to this practice of meditation. Why is it that even though the external circumstances can be conducive, that why is it that it's sometimes very hard to find that Dhamma within ourselves? Why is it so difficult sometimes to calm the mind and to get clarity? And why, what's going on that when we have, say, our retreat period, or we have so much time by ourselves, why is it that we waste time in thinking or in sleeping or in doing other things? And these are places which we should really contemplate, because once we overcome those obstacles to the path, then the path goes very smoothly and we get lots of happiness, we get lots of clarity and lots of insights, we get close to the goal which the Buddha taught. Many people come into monastic life out of faith that there is such a thing as enlightenment. There is such a thing as truth, as something to be discovered, to be attained for oneself, that which is the goal of the holy life. And having heard that and have seen some inspiring monks who are walking examples of the goal of the holy life, then it gives us the inspiration that it's possible we want to go in the same direction. So why is it that we can so easily waste those opportunities? Very often it's the core reason is that because of our delusion that we think that happiness lies somewhere else. And so often that you can see yourself wasting time seeking happiness in your old haunts, in places where you've been before, you've spent time before, thinking that happiness will lie there. And it's about time that we all recognized that where we've been before, the thoughts, the fantasies, the business, the activities, all of those things, we spent lifetimes there. What's it really gotten us? All these things, they rise and they pass away. They're unstable, they're beyond our control. We think that we can manufacture happiness there. We think that we're better than everybody else who fails, that we can do something. There's an old saying in the English language that fools rush in where arriers fear to tread. And the arriers fear to tread in those sorts of worlds, the sensory realms, the realms of hatred, the realms of too much busyness, too much contact with the world. The arriers fear to tread in those realms. Why do people rush into those realms? It's because of the stupidity of the mind. The only way to overcome that stupidity is with the two ends of the spiritual faculties, the indriyas, which is like faith and wisdom. Depending on which one you have as a strength, you have to use a little bit of each, you know, with the one which you're strong in being predominant. If one really has wisdom and knows that where the mind spends a lot of time playing, it's only going to create a lot of suffering and a lot of waste of time. It won't play there so much. It's the wisdom which sees such things as old age, sickness and death. It's the wisdom which sees that these things are inherently impossible, so inherently unable to bring you any sort of reasonable degree of happiness. And it's especially the wisdom born of experience. The path of Buddhism encourages the reflection on what you've done and what's worked and what happiness is, where you found that happiness and what you've had to do to create that happiness. You should know by now that happiness is not your birthright. It just doesn't just come to you, you have to make that happiness. And sometimes that happiness which you want to make, it takes a lot of investment, of time, of commitment, of standing your ground and working through all past karma to gain that happiness which comes further down that path. You can't expect it just to get it now. You have to build it up. You have to work, you have to train, you have to do something. That degree of wisdom by itself will give you a commitment to a path of training, to a path of development. Like growing an orchard, it takes a lot of digging and planting of the seeds and watering and guarding those trees until those trees grow. But the person who's grown that orchard, who's put forth the efforts and the time and has been very diligent, they know that later on they'll have some beautiful fruit to eat and maybe even to sell for their livelihood. The same way the person who commits themselves because they have that degree of wisdom to cultivate the mind, to cultivate this practice of the Eightfold Path, they know that after a while they'll have all the fruits of that path. It is a natural path which leads to one destination. The Eightfold Path leads to enlightenment. It's just a matter of time. But also, if one hasn't got the experiential wisdom, one should go for faith. Just the confidence that this sounds right, this feels right, there's something inside of you which tells you it's right. Very often that faith, what we recognize as faith, is no more than the distant memories from past lives. The distant echoes from past experiences where we've walked this path before and we know it feels right. It's a deeper type of wisdom. A wisdom which is hidden under the veils of so many births and deaths. But whichever one you use, you do need to have that faith or that wisdom to propel you on this path. And without that faith or without that wisdom, that's a huge obstacle, a big obstacle for you to put forth the commitment to training. Once you put forth the commitment to training, and you do need to commit yourself to this training, it will only work if you really give yourself to it. And no teacher, not even an Ajahn Chah or a Buddha, can make a person practice. They can only try and inspire them and encourage them to point out the dangers in not following this practice. I don't know what you want to do afterwards, if you want to disrobe and end up marrying some fat Russian girl, or you want to having to go to work. They look beautiful in the beginning, but after a while, I remember just when I went to Thailand from England, just going on the Aeroflot, was the cheapest flight to get to Bangkok. And I boarded the plane, this was in 1973, boarded the plane at Heathrow Airport, got on there, and as soon as, about half an hour after we'd taken off, this huge, monolithic bone crusher of a hostess came past and I asked her for a cup of tea. And I thought that's what you can usually do on an aircraft. And that's what hostesses are there for, to, flight attendants, to serve you. So I asked for a cup of tea and she glared at me and said, "Nyet." She said, "No, I couldn't believe it." It was a good story to tell later on. So I wouldn't like to be married to one of those. I'm sure that someone is, and they've regretted it. They wish they became a monk, I'm sure. But whatever it is, you know, you should. Sometimes that the way that our delusion works, we think that it's going to be better or different for us. So we do need to have a commitment that we're going to try and do something with this path, with this time which we've got. Once we have that commitment, we've got, as we've been saying many times, the four iddhipadas, we've got the chanda going, we've got the aspiration. There's something to do, we want to do it. That aspiration has to be fundamental, and so often that even monks, they can give up. They don't really want to become enlightened. They don't really want to get into jhanas. They really don't want to have those bliss states through which all the Aryas can get into. And, you know, my word, you're missing such a lot. You know, as many monks will say this, that the happiness of even like a first jhana exceeds the happiness of sexual intercourse, exceeds the happiness of heroin, exceeds all those sorts of happinesses. If you can only just commit yourself to get into those places, then the door's open for it. So with that commitment, that chanda, okay, this is what I want to do in my life. So many other lives you've done other things, how about committing this life to that one thing? And that happiness, which you get in the deep meditations, will really reinforce the wisdom. It will overcome just so many obstacles to meditation. Once a person's had a taste of that sort of happiness, they can never forget it, they can never avoid it, they always have to go back to this sooner or later. Because it's a happiness which is not only intense and beautiful, but it's has this aspect to it of tremendous wisdom. This is something profound. It's, as the Buddha said, it's like Sambodhisukha. It's like the happiness which is close to the happiness of enlightenment. Sambodhisukha means happiness of enlightenment. It's the happiness of renunciation. It's the happiness of letting go. It's the footsteps of the Buddha. In the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, footsteps of the Buddha. So these are some powerful descriptions of what's going on here. So if we can just get one experience or a close experience of that state, it's such a powerful, so profound, so wonderful, so deep, of course it's going to create even more chanda to pursue the Eightfold Path. Once you have that commitment, that chanda, you really want to do it. The next thing, which is an obstacle, it's like not really understanding what the instructions are, what you should be doing. This is where you want to get. Okay, next thing is read the roadmap. And of course, for those people who have come from all sorts of different traditions and read all sorts of different books, there's all sorts of different explanations and what roadmap you're supposed to use and which way you're supposed to go and what shortcuts you can take, because everyone likes to take shortcuts. So the best of the roadmaps will always be the Buddha's teachings, and the best of those teachings will always be the Eightfold Path. In the Dhammapada it says it's the best of all paths is the Eightfold Path. The chief of those paths is the Eightfold Path. So we're talking about techniques and ways and means. One always has to look at that Eightfold Path. This is the way to meditate. This is the way to develop the path. This is vipassana practice, this is samatha practice, this is bhavana. This is really what we should be doing if we're really serious about becoming enlightened, if we're really serious about ending suffering. If we've got enough faith, enough wisdom, and enough courage to do something about this. So, that Eightfold Path, enough right view, each one of you got enough good view. Sometimes you argue together, I argue with you, but it's only on small matters. But the right thought is what you can really focus on. Because such a big obstacle to success on this path is like through wrong thinking. Remember what those right thought is, nekama vitaka. avyapada vitakka and ahimsaka vitakka, thoughts of letting go, renunciation, giving up, abandoning, and thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of harmlessness. Just look at those. Just thoughts of abandoning, letting go, giving up. These are tremendously powerful aids to remove the obstacles for meditation. To get a mind of just wanting to give up, to give away, to let go, to simplify, to empty, to remove, to free. That's what that word means, freeing. Nekama, giving up, means giving up the fetters, giving up the burdens, giving up the weights. So we have that ideal in our mind. Let's see how much we can give up. And of course, it's not just giving up possessions. You've got few possessions as it is. It's mostly like giving up some of the thoughts and ideas which one has. Especially giving up the thinking itself. To be able to give up the thinking is very difficult because so many people make the mistake of just looking at the object rather than looking at the doer. Because I've said this before many times sitting here, if you try and give up one thing which is outside of you, you'll find you pick up something else, you have to give that up and you pick something else up. It's an endless trying to give things up and you never really achieve anything. When you're talking about thoughts of renunciation, it's thoughts of especially renouncing this thing inside. You know, the six classes of consciousness. Renouncing chedana, giving up will, giving up doing. Because you find that so much of the obstacles to meditation, the obstacles to the path, they come from this sense of ego, from self, always doing, always wanting to manipulate, always wanting to change and control things. So that's where the nekama vitakka should really sort of focus on. Not just out there, but really in here. So really stupid people want to sort of change others around them. They want to manipulate and control other people. Just these are the external objects. When they start to look inside of themselves, they try and change their internal objects. They're still missing the point. It's just trying to change the changer. Trying to let go of the doer. This is where we overcome the main obstacle to deep meditation. Just look at yourself. How much have you done today? Why did you do it? What's the point of this doer? And where does it ever get you? You can do. One of the great advantages of a monastery such as this at this time of the year, that there is nothing much to do. And it's strange, isn't it, that even though there's nothing much to do, even though you're on retreat, even though that you don't even have to worry about your food getting to you, still we can think and plan all these things we're supposed to do, have all these projects, and sometimes they become so important to us. So important that they become the most important thing in the whole monastery. My project, what I'm supposed to do, what I have to do. Be careful of that mind state. It's just giving importance to the doer. It's an illusion, and it's just a big obstacle to the path. The right view is thoughts of letting go. Sometimes that doing is motivated also by ill will. That's why the every now and again thoughts of loving kindness, meditations on loving kindness, become extremely powerful to get deep in meditation. And I sort of often wondered myself, why is it that sometimes just a few moments of loving kindness meditation overcome so many obstacles? And the reason is because the ill will is such a powerful obstacle to deep meditation and to enlightenment. And it's an obstacle which is quite invisible to many people. You can tell it's an obstacle if, when you do loving kindness meditation, you're You can do loving kindness meditation, and this is how you can tell whether it's an obstacle or not. This is how you can tell whether thoughts of ill will are really present in you. If you find it, one, difficult to do loving kindness meditation, and number two, if you can do it and things start to get very deep and very peaceful, it means that there was an obstacle there. That there is such a thing as ill will in you, which you can't see. Remember, many of these obstacles, these are kilesas, defilements, sort of are all based in ignorance, illusion, delusion. You can't expect to really see them. You only can find them out, find they're there by doing these little tests and probes. Do loving kindness and meditation. If there's a difficulty there, this you've got a problem. If you manage to succeed and it gets very deep, then it was a problem. It's strange that why loving kindness meditation works. Sometimes that ill will is all about control. The doer is almost the best friend of ill will, because when we are discontent, the root of ill will is being discontent, being fault-finding. When we have that fault-finding mind, we're discontent. It's from that that we've got a problem, we've got something to do. There's some business at hand. The opposite of all of that is developing loving kindness, which actually embraces things as they are, which can accept things as they are, which can live with things as they are, which can be at peace with things as they are. Loving kindness towards oneself means one is at peace with oneself in this moment. Loving kindness towards one's heart means one is at peace with one's heart. Loving kindness with regard to one's position in the monastery means one's at peace with that. It's a sense of tolerance in which contentment can arise. But whenever there's ill will towards oneself, towards the teacher, towards the monastery, towards the system, there's always something to be done. When there's something to be done, there'll be a doer, there'll be restlessness, there'll be disturbance. That's why vipada creates a sense of doing, a sense of restlessness. So it's good to develop loving kindness as much as one can in order to stop all this doing business and all this restlessness. If one can develop that loving kindness and get into restless, get into a more peace, we can even look at the developing ahimsaka, vitaka, thoughts of non-cruelty, thoughts of non-harm. And sometimes that we think that I'm not harming anybody, and you're wrong, you're harming yourself. Why do you harm yourself by sleeping in so much? You feel much better when you get up early in the morning. You feel much more energy. Why are you harming yourself by not developing the beautiful meditations? You're harming yourself, preventing yourself enjoying the beauty of these things. You're allowing yourself to get involved in more old age, sickness and death. You're harming your spiritual health. It's like smoking harms your body. In this case, the lack of following the Eightfold Path harms your mental health, your mental stability. I certainly know that when I get into some nice meditation, I just get so happy. All the energies come up and everything looks just bright and cheerful in the whole world. And this is, I realize if I'm not putting forth effort and being diligent in my meditation, that I'm harming myself. I know there was a time just after I'd been practicing meditation for 1 year, quite diligently. The second year I was not so diligent. I was taking it easy. I was taking the happiness for granted and it started to disappear. I really wondered what had gone wrong. You really realize just what meditation does to you. If you practice the path, you have a sense of happiness and harmony inside. You have this inner joy. But if you don't practice that path, you're harming yourself, preventing yourself from enjoying the fruits of this path. Is it just something you can experience for yourself? The times when you've really been happy, what have you been doing? What is the cause of that happiness? So don't harm yourself, that's crazy. So when we understand that the way we use our thinking is just so important to develop our own happiness and well-being and our freedom and our insight, our wisdom, our understanding, a lot of one's attention should be placed upon this thinking mind. If you are going to use thinking at all, make sure it's something which is kusala, which is wholesome, which is connected to the path. Now the wholesome speech is that which is like talking about things like fewness of wishes, talking about sila samadhi panya, talking about Buddha Dhamma Sangha. As one would talk, you know, to the teacher, so one should think. Just because I had to take Venerable Jyotipanya to the CT scan today, I thought it would be wonderful to have one in the monastery so we can test out what all the monks are thinking about. You can look inside your brain. Would you really like your brain to be scanned or your mind to be scanned and know what you've been thinking about? So have a sense of hiriyotapa, a sense of shame and fear of the consequences of that karma. Look at one's thinking mind and train it to be beautiful, train it to be peaceful, train it to be on the Dhamma. It's not only just for the sake of your own sense of self-worth, but also for the sense of happiness. By cultivating the thoughts, the right thoughts, good thoughts, you're actually practicing along the path. Remember that sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the two types of thoughts? Where the Lord Buddha in his early days as a Bodhisattva, if he saw any thought which was unwholesome, he'd stop it. And he'd just cultivate wholesome thoughts, kind thoughts. And you all know the difference between the two. In brief, the wholesome, the kind thoughts are those which lead to happiness, which lead to peace, which lead to freedom, which lead to wisdom, which lead to nibbana. And the unwholesome ones just end up creating pain and suffering inside of you. So be wise and don't sort of harm yourself with those types of thoughts. The strange thing is that once you start to develop good thoughts, wholesome thoughts, that those good thoughts, wholesome thoughts tend to end all the business and start to quieten the mind, and you start to get no thoughts. Start to get the emptiness of the mind, the quietness of the mind, the peace of the mind. There's sometimes that when I have to go into town and just hear all these people talking and sitting in the this medical center today, there was music playing all the time. It's just so nice to come back to your hut and sit there. There's no music playing. There's no sound of people. It's just yourself alone in the quietness. That quietness, that silence is recognized to be so beautiful, so happy. This is what I'm saying, that with your wisdom to recognize the happiness which is out there in the silence, and then you may be able to recognize the silence within yourself. So having that right path, now the right understanding about what works, having a good map, and learning that map as you go along, learning what creates the peace and happiness of the mind, can start to overcome the obstacles to your meditation. You're going to be smart, not foolish. You're going to contemplate, not just believe in your old ideas. The old ideas which a person has, the habits which you have, they're just ingrained, and they can be outgrained, degrained, if you like. Otherwise, they'll be migrained. So you've got to be very careful to not give yourself a headache with these old patterns of thinking and old behavioural patterns. But be smart, be wise, challenge these. And do you really want to be like this for the rest of your life, or do you want to be free? Do you want to be liberated? Do you want to experience some of these peaceful states? So with that motivation, get on the Eightfold Path, and as you proceed along this path, you'll see what happens. with that degree of wisdom, with that degree of faith, when you follow the instructions, then things start to happen. Because this Eightfold Path, once you have that right view there and the right thought, you know, the beautiful thoughts, all the other factors of the path start to come into line. It's very easy to keep the precepts. Because all the precepts start in the mind. As you think, so you start to speak, and so you start to act. If you're always thinking that the monk who sits next to you, above you, is a slob, sooner or later you're going to call him that. If you start to think sexual thoughts and sexual fantasies, sure enough, you're going to one day act them out. So see if you can cultivate the beautiful thoughts. Thoughts which give you freedom, not thoughts which give you entanglement. But these are for your happiness, for your peace, for your freedom, for your insight, for your wisdom. This is what I've been doing for 26 years, and I'm happy enough. Once you can actually start to recognize this, then you start to be walking on the path. And as you get far enough on this path, you start to get some peace and tranquility coming up. You start to notice the process of enlightenment. You know, one of the difficulties in one of the obstacles which you can sometimes get is this body. It's always too hot, too cold. It's got coughs. It's got hay fever. It's got aches and pains. It's got stomach aches. It's got this wrong with it and that wrong with it. And sometimes you sit down, you can't make it still. This body is a pain. And the only time you can get rid of this bodily discomfort, or put it another way, bodily restlessness, is to develop this thing called kaya prasadi. So the tranquility of the body. And many of you will recognize that term, kaya prasadi, is a central part in a whole process, a causal sequence, which leads to deep samadhi and to wisdom and to enlightenment. But because many people do suffer sicknesses and aches and pains, and they can't sit for very long, it's important to point out how that kaya prasadi arises. That kaya prasadi arises through piti, through this joy and delight in what you're doing, especially in the meditation object. You can develop a little bit of joy and delight in what you're doing. What happens is it takes the mind off this body and onto another object. So this body can be left alone to balance. Because if you're always doing something with this body, if you're always caught up with this body, if you're always attached to this body, craving in this body, craving for heat, craving for cold, craving for the end of all these symptoms, it's endless. It'll just keep you going for the rest of your lifetimes, not just this life, again and again and again and again. That's why I found I'm never as healthy, in the sense that never as unconcerned with my body as when you're in meditation and just afterwards. There the body can be just so still and peaceful, you don't even care about it, you're not even aware of it. That's called kaya prasadi. Even if you want sort of sex, or if you want to eat, that's just the opposite of kaya prasadi. That sort of restlessness of the body. The body seeking for some happiness, pleasure, stimulation, whatever it is. So this kaya prasadi is the end of all of that. It's a freedom from that. It's a marvelous stage of meditation to experience, contemplate and realize. This is the end of the bodily hunger. Everything else you do is just like a thirsty person eating salty water. Because you get even more thirsty afterwards. But the kaya prasadi, the getting the tranquility of the body, leads to full quenching of the body for the time being. The body doesn't need anything, you can leave it alone for a change. that kaya prasadi will come if you can just follow the instructions of doing things like present moment awareness and silence and just watching the breath. Do that very gently until the breath is accompanied with piti, with a sense of beauty and joy. It's developing a beautiful perception of a very simple object. Then you'll find that at that particular stage in the meditation you can sit for long periods of time quite comfortably because you have achieved kaya prasadi, the tranquility of the body. All the attention is just on the mind and the body is left completely alone. You're not really interested in food, you're not really interested in walking, doing this, doing that, because the body is quietened. It's as if like a big burden has been dropped from you. The restlessness of the body is the obstacle here. You have to sit the body still somewhere and put the mind somewhere else. It's the substitution method for overcoming that particular obstacle. Because if you try something else by following that body, by scratching the itches, by trying to find health in this body, you're just wasting your time. Many of you are already sick. Those of you who aren't already, you soon will be. The only way you can let go of this body is through the meditation. Otherwise, you're just going to end up suffering physically, because you don't know the tranquility of the body. Much of that tranquility of the body comes through the perfection of your precepts. This is all part of the Eightfold Path. If you haven't got purity of your precepts, you'll find that the restlessness which comes from remorse will bother you. You won't be able to sit still. You won't be able to realize that health of a balanced, peaceful body which disappears. And of course you need the mindfulness, the effort from commitment, is to do the samadhi practice. This is what you might call one of the first stages of samadhi. You know, the tranquility of the body. And that usually comes, or usually precedes, the tranquility of the mind. If the body isn't tranquil, if there's something to do with this body, something to scratch, some medicine to take this body to the toilet or whatever, lay it down to sleep, there's no tranquility of the body. There's no tranquility of the mind. The mind is burdened. It's got another duty to be done. I know many of you have started this retreat. You're trying to get things out of the way so you can meditate, to write all your letters, to wash all your clothes, to mend this and mend that, to do all the library books or whatever else. You're trying to get out of the way so you can meditate. The other thing you've got to get out of the way to meditate is this body. Get this body out of the way. The way to get this body out of the way so you've got no business to do there is again through this power of meditation. Present moment awareness, silence, watching the breath, and the body disappears. Kaya prasadi. And then you can get to the citta prasadi, the tranquility of the mind, where there's nothing much to do. If you're not doing anything with the body, you're not doing anything outside, stop doing things with your mind and the meditation object. This is actually where the really starts to become subtle in your understanding of the Dhamma. As soon as you've got the beautiful breath, that each one of you should get that beautiful breath in this range retreat with hardly any problem whatsoever. It's just what you do afterwards takes that skill and subtlety. The skill and subtlety of once you have a beautiful breath in mind, a breath which is delightful to watch, the body's disappeared. This is just to increase that beauty, just by letting go more and more and more and more. The Dhamma of the Four Noble Truths always says that it's letting go, renunciation, more and more, getting rid of even subtle forms of the doer, which is the path to Nibbana. More and more craving, more and more doing is the path to suffering. Now that calming down It's not calm, as I was saying to someone in a retreat interview, that calming down is not so much calming down of the object, of the breath, because that's more doing. It's calming down of the person watching that object. Calm down the watcher of the beautiful breath. Don't sort of focus so much on calming down the breath. Because if you calm down the watcher, the observer, then the breath calms down by itself. It's a simile of a hunter stalking the prey. If the prey realizes the hunter's around, it will always be agitated. It will never calm down and be still. But if the hunter just is so quiet and so still, doesn't move, so the prey doesn't know there's a hunter around, there's a person around, then they will relax and they become still and they become peaceful. In the same way, when you're watching the breaths, just get that metaphor of there's somebody watching and this breath is being watched. See if you can calm down the watcher, the observer. And then you'll find the breath becomes calm. So it's this thing inside that you are making gentle, you're making peaceful. And then you get the hang of what this letting go is. You're letting go of the doing, and that doing is coming from within you. You're developing the opposite of doing, which is contentment. You're just content with a beautiful breath, and the more content you are with a beautiful breath, the more beautiful it becomes. You're getting the hang of this thing we call meditation. And you find it's very easy because you don't have to do anything. You just have to watch this do and just shut it up, calm it down, make it peaceful. And it encourages you because the more you do this, the more happiness you get, the more profound your meditation. You're really understanding nekamma, letting go. And you're understanding why most people just miss the point because they're always calming down someone else, not themselves. They're calming down the object of the meditation rather than they're calming down the observer of the meditation. When they calm this observer down more and more, they get more and more peaceful, they got the point. They know how to meditate. And they can take that further and further and further. Just calm the observer and just the beautiful breath comes up. More and more and more, there's nothing to say because all of that saying, all of those words comes from an agitated observer. An observer who's restless. And just what's being watched just becomes very still. The contentment grows and grows and grows. The power of meditation is the cumulative effect of moments and moments of contentment. The more you can develop that contentment, the more still you become. The more still that you become, the more focused the energy. And just all these other stages of meditation, the nimitta just comes up all by itself. There you are seeing a beautiful, blissful experience. And why is that happening? Because you're calming down the observer. You can only allow a nimitta to come up if you're very still indeed inside. Until the observer is almost speechless. Unable to do anything, just watching. This becomes a nice reinforcement. It gives you more courage, more faith, more confidence to sort of to let go even more and just to see that inside the observer which is maybe moving even further. Once you get nimittas, it gets quite easy to know if you're moving because if you move, the nimitta moves. A nimitta is no more than a reflection. Like a person looking at their face in a mirror. If the image in the mirror moves, it's because the person is moving. The one looking is moving. The observer is moving. That's why the image moves. And the only way to calm down that nimitta, to get it still, is for the person watching to be still. And we understand what letting go means, letting go of the doer. And here you're so refined that it's so easy to know whether you're doing or whether you're still, because the nimitta moves, it tells you straight away. And so you really learn very quickly and very easily, if you've got a bit of sense, that to keep that nimitta still, you've got to really let go of almost the last vestige of doing. As you do, as that happens, as that occurs, you begin to really open up your grip on the world, release the world from your doing, temporarily abandon the self of doing, then the nimitta becomes just so still and so beautiful that falling in and gaining a jhana. And come out afterwards, and you should be able to review that whole path, what went on, the whole path of renunciation, of letting go, and understanding you've been letting go of the illusion of self which does all of this. You're seeing the truth of happiness and suffering, you're seeing anatta in action, and you're getting these beautiful states of meditation all at the same time. It's a great deal. Cannot be beaten in the whole of samsara. And this is all coming from seeing the obstacles to meditation and overcoming them one by one. Those obstacles which I mentioned today, like the commitment, wanting to do this, seeing the dangers in not doing this, getting a bit fed up with not doing this, and saying, okay, I'm here, I might as well get on with it. Once you get on with it, remembering the instructions. Make sure you know the path very well. And pay special attention, as I pointed out during this talk, to the second of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right thought. Look at that area there, because that's one of the biggest obstacles for monks meditating here. Not cultivating, guarding that second aspect of the Eightfold Path. And use the meditation, or use first of all the two types of thought by the Buddha, and then use the Eightfold Path. And then overcome this doing little by little. And when you get to beautiful breath, there it should be reasonably easy, once you've been told the instructions, to take it deeper and deeper and deeper. And once you start getting into these beautiful states of mind, you don't need me to teach you. Everything, the whole Dharma is there right in front of your eyes. So peaceful, so beautiful, so obvious. So easy, so freeing. And it's yours. You've got there. And then you realize that your aspirations in this monastic life have been mostly met. It's only a short path from there to take that to full enlightenment. So you have the opportunity in this retreat. It doesn't matter if you have these other business and duties to do. You don't have to do this when you're in your hut. Don't take your work back into your room. When you get into that area around your hut, that's the meditation place. That's meditation time. And so guard that space. Guard that quietness. Have the confidence and faith to walk this path. And I guarantee if you really walk this path and you build up this path, it will give you all the happiness and joy and all the wisdom you could ever, ever want. So that's the talk this evening. Has anyone got any comments or questions on this talk? Yes, go on. This means chanda and chetana. But chanda is the aspiration, the inclination of the mind, which is set up that when you point the mind in one particular direction. The chetana, which I'm talking about, the doer, is when you've made that that aspiration, that direction, you keep interfering. The best metaphor, simile, which I've been given is you have to go to, say, the airport to get a plane to go and visit your family over in New South Wales. And as soon as you get out this gate, you tell the driver, say Amanda's is driving you there, you tell Amanda, I've got to get to the airport. Amanda's knows the way, he's been there many times. That's Chanda saying, I want to go to the airport. And the Chaitana, the doer which keeps on interfering, is always saying, come on Amanda, let's get to the airport. Go along the Tonkin Highway. No, go along the freeway this time. So go fast, go slow. Can you please stop in Armidale at the hardware store on the way? All these things, that's the Chaitana which interferes with the journey. All these other things which you have to do. So you got the Chanda, but don't sort of interfere it with all these other little Chaitanas which interfere with it. Okay, that's enough for tonight, because I'm quite tired.
Sutatipano Bhagavata.